You're listening to The Aaron Carrera Show, and now your host, Aaron Carrera.
Hey, everybody. Good morning and happy Independence Day if you're in the United States of America and you are celebrating. And if not, happy Thursday. It's July 4th, 10:02 a.m. I'm coming at you live, if you're listening live, from Los Angeles, California, where it is a gorgeous morning. The birds are singing. My husband's playing soccer outside in the backyard here. What else could a girl ask for, huh? Who could ask for anything more? Well, I mean, a lot of us ask for more, but that's not the subject of today's show. So, hi, it's me. It's Erin. You're listening to The Erin Carrera Show on 1-2 Radio, brought to you by me, Erin, at 1-2Listen.com. That is 1-2Listen.com/Erin. I will be available on 1-2Listen today. We're having sales today and tomorrow, so come find me. I would love to speak with you, chat with you. You can order some email-based services. And for those of you who have been, if you happen to listen to Backstage Pass, for example, or be on my social media, you know that I had a book come out on Tuesday. So my very first novella. I'm very proud of this little novella that could. And today we're going to be talking about a couple of different things. We're going to be talking about the book and how to use writing to heal. And we'll probably also talk about that next week. But I also love to go with what's coming to me, what is presented to me. And so Jay, you know, lovely producer Jay, and I were just chatting about time. How is it already the 4th of July? Like, it was just, I was saying, for example, I was just in Minneapolis, but that was a month ago. I was just, you know, visiting my parents were just visiting me, but that was February. And we were just opening this bottle of champagne that my friend Allison had given us for our wedding. We saved it and we opened it on my birthday. But then if I think like, oh my gosh, like my wedding feels in a way, like I remember every detail as though it were yesterday. But the truth is that was December 21st, 2021, you know, that was almost 3 years ago. I can think about, you know, time is so strange. Now, part of the reason time is strange is because of relativity, right? Albert Einstein famously said, when you sit with a nice girl for 2 hours, it seems like 2 minutes. But when you sit on a hot stove for 2 minutes, it seems like 2 hours. And that is relativity. Well, we know that time is not what we make of it. But hey, everybody, let's take a nice collective long, slow, deep breath in and out. But time is moving extra fast lately. It is. So many people have been having this experience of time moving at roller coaster speed. Well, roller coaster speed is slow, 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 fast. Slow, 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 fast, isn't it? But indeed, time is moving at a very fast rate spiritually. And there are ways to deal, I guess I'll put it that way. But the number one thing I would love for us to start with is by getting into our bodies. So let's all take one hand and put our hand on our heart. And if you're seated, I'm seated. If you're seated, I want you to just feel the support of the chair underneath you. If you're lying down on a yoga mat, feel the yoga mat and the ground beneath you and how it's supporting all of your body. If you're standing, feel the bottom of your feet on the floor and how that floor is supporting you, okay? I want you to take a nice, long, slow, deep breath in and hold it at the top and then let it go with a sigh. That's right. Let's do another one of those. Put your hand on your heart. I want you to think about the bottoms of your feet. Think about your calves. Think about the back of your thighs, the front of your thighs. Think about your booty. Think about your lower abdomen, your lower back. Think about the left side of your body, the right side of your body. Think about your upper abdomen. Think about your chest, your heart. Think about the left side of your back, the right side of your back. Think about your spine from the top of your neck all the way down to your tailbone. Think about your left arm, left hand and fingers. Think about your right arm, your right hand and fingers. Think about the back of your neck, the left side of your neck, right side of your neck. Think about your face. Think about the top of your head. Now, take a nice, long, slow, deep breath in. Hold it at the top. And let it go with a sigh. Okay. So now that we're in our bodies, we can talk a little bit about time. Right? So, right now, we are living in a time where time is going very fast in some ways, and that is the ascension, right? That is the ways that we are, time is speeding up to grow us faster and faster. And yet, I feel that one of the wonderful ways to manage time and to, in fact, I'll put it this way, increase your awareness, which can lead to enlightenment, right? Because, of course, in moments of enlightenment or after one is enlightened, but I don't want to speak as though I'm some sort of expert on that as much as I've had moments, the flow of time is altered. And I feel, my experience is such, that the more quiet and the more still you are within yourself, the more you let go of haste and hurry, and yeah, sometimes you need to, right? My book came out on Tuesday. The last few days, I was not grounded, or I had to work very hard to get myself grounded because I had all of this. I had interviews to give. I had emails to send. I had social media to do. I had books to send to people. I had work to do around that and a lot, in addition to also doing all of my other jobs. Now, that's my joy. It's not a complaint, but I was going fast. But if you slow down yourself, you quiet yourself, actually, the more you're in the busy energy, you'll see, the more you're in the busy energy, like time is used against you. But if you slow yourself down, you can see that you are always here. And then you don't have that friction of time. Right? The friction of time is there. You could tap into it anytime you want. The friction of time, the human collective mimetic viruses around time, I don't have enough time, I'm so busy, all of that stuff, right? Yes, it's true that time itself speeds and slows and speeds and slows. Or our perception of it, really. Because time is just time. But we can play with time. And I slowed my voice down to show you that's so. And trust me, it's not always easy. I can feel my heart rate because I am in go, go, go. My mind is in go, go, go. My little Aries moon is in go, go, go right now. And it wants to say, stop, Aaron. Speak a million miles a minute to try to get close to the way your thoughts are racing. Go fast. You have too much to cover. You have too much to share. You have too much to do to take this time. But the truth is, I'm also in a body. I'm also in a body that sometimes can go fast, sometimes can go, 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 but that also really craves slowing down enough to feel my emotions, slowing down enough to be in this body. To let the divine take care of some of that stuff. And you know what's kind of crazy wild? Is that when I am here in my body, and sometimes I'm fast and sometimes I'm slow. Sometimes music, right? I went to the orchestra on Saturday. Sometimes the music is lento, that means slow. Sometimes it's allegro moderato, that means, moderately fast. Sometimes it's vivace, that's fast, right? Well, that's just like us. But when we get caught up in always having to be fast, which is a kind of sickness that Western culture is having right now, we actually become used by our idea of time rather than participating with spirit in life. So someone important to me in my life, I won't say who, but somebody that I love in my life is having a very big birthday today. Happy birthday. And I sent him this, a few quotes about turning the birthday that he's having. One of them is, what Abraham Lincoln said, and I think that's valuable for this moment when we're talking about time. In the end, it's not the years in your life that count, it's the life in your years. I'll say that again. In the end, it's not the years in your life that count, it is the life in your years. So remember that. At any given moment, you can get in your body. And now some of you might be saying, but Aaron, when I get in my body, I feel things I don't want to feel. Why don't you want to feel them? What's the worst thing that could happen? Do you think those feelings will kill you? I know some people do. And I will say, you know, my grandfather was very stubborn. Once when he was confronted with a very terrible thing, he had such a shock that he did die the next day of a heart attack at the age of 76, which is not, you know, we would have loved more time with him, but also, without getting into my family business, it was a very terrible thing that had happened. And so it's sort of like there are aspects of our lives that we think we can control that we can't. But just as my grandfather needed to be confronted and need to feel those feelings that he had shoved down for decades, and it all came to him as a shock that gave him a heart attack, I'm asking you not to do that. I'm asking you to actually allow some of those feelings in so you don't have a sudden shock when the truth is put in front of your face in a way you can't deny, if in fact that should ever happen to you. There's nothing to be afraid of. Right? Like we talked about last week, there are things to be afraid of, but fear is a friend sometimes. Fear is a teacher. So another beautiful aspect of time, there is, if any of you are familiar with the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore, there's a poem on time. Time is endless in thy hands, my Lord. There is none to count thy minutes. Days and nights pass, and ages bloom and fade like flowers. Thou knowest how to wait. Thy centuries follow each other, perfecting a small wild flower. We have no time to lose, and having no time, we must scramble for chances. We are too poor to be late. And thus it is that time goes by, while I give it to every querulous man who claims it, and thine altar is empty of all offerings to the last. At the end of the day, I hasten in fear, lest thy gate be shut. But I find that yet there is time. So I know that's a little bit existential and intellectual, but I wanted to share it. Because what we're talking about with this poem is we actually believe we don't have enough time. And it's true that a human life compared to totality is short and small. But actually, time is one of the few things we are given as a birthright. We are given time. We are given attention, meaning we are given the ability to pay attention or not. We are given a heart that beats, and if that heart stops working, we no longer exist. We are given breath. If we stop breathing, we no longer exist. But time and attention. We cannot control time, but we can control our attention. In fact, I just listened yesterday to this very cool TED Talk that the actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt gave about time and attention. And he was talking about how as an actor, when he's acting, he loses track of time because he becomes so focused. His focus narrows in on exactly what's happening in his scene with his acting partner. He becomes so focused on his acting partner, so focused on what's happening, that it's a different experience of time. And that his ability to give attention gives him a deeper experience of time. And then he was talking about how his need for attention actually gives him less joy. But it's a very good talk. I would highly recommend people going to listen to it. Well, in fact, when we tap into the divine, or attention and focus, as Joseph Gordon-Levitt calls it, or flow, I'll get into a flow state, or even if we're just normal, having a normal daily life, doing the laundry, right? Cleaning our dirty glasses with spray, like I just did. Even if that's what we're doing, we can still be giving our attention and change our relationship to time. Yep, sometimes you multitask. Sometimes you clean your glasses while you're talking about time. But sometimes that's actually all still part of the attention that you're giving to your heart, the attention you're giving to what's in front of you, the attention that you're giving to your life, the attention you're giving to your love. And do you know why I started the show out talking about time and attention? Because I was not grounded and I was freaked out about time. And so I wanted to give myself the gift of changing my relationship to time. So thank you for sharing that with me. And now I want to talk to you all about my book, okay? Shameless, it's not shameless self-promotion, actually. I want to talk to you about how I wrote it and how you too can write, not a book, although you can if you want, more so it's about how we can use writing to really heal. So there are a lot of different reasons to write things, right? You know, why do we write? Why do we want to tell stories? Why do we want to share our personal stories or stories that we think are fun, right? Of course, we want to communicate with others, although sometimes, honestly, during the experience of writing itself, I'm just communicating with myself. I'm feeling back, right? What feels right or what doesn't feel right, right? If I'm writing with my husband, it's like we're sharing and creating together. As a couple, that's part of our life together, is to create together and to grow together in that way, right? We write to learn things, to teach things, to persuade other people, to entertain other people. You know, I wrote this book to entertain. The truth is, actually, I wrote this book to bless. One of the goals in my life that I decided for myself a long time ago is that it doesn't matter what happens in my life in terms of like success or money. Those things, of course, I'm an ambitious person, but I will always leave it to the divine to use me to be of service. That I would use my talents to bless people. I would use my talents to be of service, to love to the best of my ability. And then the rest of the time, just, you know, look to enjoy my life, look to love. So although I wrote the book Bad Sugar Baby to entertain people, I also really wrote it to love people. Now that might sound silly or highfalutin or a little bit, you know, preposterous or very Hollywood. I don't know. Whatever. I don't care. It's my truth, right? So sometimes we write to heal psychological and spiritual wounds. Sometimes we're writing to create entire imaginary worlds. Sometimes we just need to express feelings. Sometimes we're trying to chronicle experiences for posterity or for others to understand. Sometimes we're exploring the meaning behind events and situations, right? And then if you think about your audience, that's what makes the context of writing social. So when I'm writing with my husband and we're writing a screenplay, then the context there is we're writing for ourselves, for producers, for actors, for Hollywood, for filmmakers, right? But also, when I wrote this novella, I specifically chose a target audience, and I wanted to write something that I thought would speak to them. And it happens to include me in that target audience, so it kind of helped a little bit, because I know the books I like to read, and I know what I like to read. So I did kind of, in a way, write for the things that I might like to read. Writing also builds relationships. Now, you might write something that you don't share with other people, but it's still growing your relationship with yourself, right? If you're in a group of writers, you might be writing, you are building relationships with your writer's group. Or, you know, like I was mentioning recently, a lot of the people who are buying my book first are friends, and I'm grateful. It's so wonderful. Some of these are friends, for example, that are pen pals, or people I write a lot of emails with, people I've created plays and TV series with, people who have known me intimately for a long time. And a lot of them say, oh my God, there's so much Erin in this book. It's so Erin. It's just so Erin, which I get tickled by, because it's like, yeah, I mean, just like there's no one like you, there's no one like me, right? And that brings me to another thing about writing, which is it's a product of the self, right? It's a product of you. David Foster Wallace was such a genius, and he writes just like him, right? He writes like him. He writes his essays differently than his fiction, but rest assured, it's just like him. Anne of Green Gables, one of my favorite books of all time, written by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Well, I have read all of her journals, a lot of her poems, a lot of her letters, a lot of her books, and I know she greatly curated her writing. Like, if people were to read my journal, like right now, they would look at, like, for example, it's just a mess. Like, a lot of times it's a combination of a list of what I need to do today, a prayer that I write, because I write my prayers, notes for my Italian class. So people would look at this journal and they'd be like, Dear Divine, thank you for Finch Benson, right? Like, that's the publishing company of my book. Wednesday, 3rd July, 9 a.m., Italian class, 12, Jay and Raven, right? That's what I did yesterday. And then they would go to the next page and they would see a bunch of Italian words: siepe, hedge, prato, prairie, sulle ginocchia, piste ciclabili, right? It'd be like, what the heck? So I did not curate this for other people to look at, is my point. But Lucy Maud Montgomery curated her journals. But the way she writes her books is the way she writes her journals is similar to the way she writes her letters. She might reveal more of her intimate personal life in her letters, but the way she writes is the way she writes. Also, writing, of course, has changed a lot. It has evolved a lot in our digitally connected world. It has evolved partially because we use fewer words. In a way, we use fewer words to say the same thing. And in another way, we use a lot more words, right? There's, I think, something to authentic writing and writing something that is really about you that I think can be healing and that I think also can have some real transformative change in your life. And that's what I wanted to talk about with Bad Sugar Baby. So Bad Sugar Baby, I have another novel that I wrote. It's called Ghosting Shakespeare. I love it. I'm very proud of it. And this publishing company, they're called Finch Benson, they are going to be publishing that this autumn. And they emailed me and they said, hey, Erin, we were thinking, do you have like a fun, sexy beach read, you know, like just a novella, like 30, 40,000 words that we could release this summer to introduce you to our readers? And I was like, well, I have a couple screenplays that I could adapt as a novella pretty easily. So I pitched them those, and they're like, nah. And then I thought about this idea I had for a screenplay. So let me backtrack to where the idea came from. So some of you may know that I have done some one-woman shows. The very first one-woman show I ever did was called The One. It was all about my love life. The second one-woman show I did was called Stand Up, and it was all about singing. And I've had some people request that I bring back my original one-woman show, The One, because in that I talk about my love life and I deconstructed my love life. And I learned that the common denominator in my back then crazy, tragic, difficult love life was, in fact, me. I really learned a lot about the ways that I was behaving in relationship and the ways that my behavior was creating difficult and sometimes tragic results and creating a lot of suffering and misery, certainly for me and sometimes for the other person. So at the same time, I was getting my life coaching training and I really began to delve deep into relationship coaching, love coaching. Okay. And then the very next year I started working at One to Listen. Well, I have been thinking about updating that One Woman Show because, you know, 14 years later, a lot has changed. I met my husband. I got married. I've been in a long-term relationship. I have learned a lot about long-term love and the beauty of long-term love and how different it is from the beginning of a relationship. And so many people seem to get really freaked out by that. They get really like sad, or they mourn the early days of the relationship. And sure, maybe it's a little less exciting in a certain kind of way, but actually it's very exciting in this other way, because every day I'm so grateful for my husband. Every day I'm just so grateful that he's him, that he's just so wonderful, that I know who he is deeply and he knows who I am deeply. And we can be totally ourselves around each other. We get to just be exactly totally ourselves. We don't have to pretend, right? We don't have to put on a pretense. You know, sure, every once in a while, a little mystery goes a long way. But I just don't have to pretend, right? There's so many things. If something is important to one of us, the other one is there for it. If there's a family issue, the other one is there for it. With the commitment and the depth of commitment is so beautiful. Anyway, so I was thinking about revamping my One Woman Show when I'm thinking about, okay, well, what would I include? Would I include something I've been calling Minnesota training? Because I've been thinking a lot about all of the ways that my Minnesota training, meaning growing up in Minnesota and growing up in that culture and having a lot of that culture be indoctrinated into me and therefore seem inherent to who I am as a person, the ways that that's held me back, but also the ways that that has really helped me in life, right? Like, I grew up a little passive aggressive. I grew up a people pleaser. I grew up with a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. I grew up not believing that you get to stand out or you get to be special, which really harmed me in my performing life. But I also grew up learning how to care for other people, pay attention to other people, help other people. I grew up, you know, learning to love education, loving reading, loving the outdoors, loving nature. I learned how to think of my fellow as well as myself. And I think that's a good thing. It's not always rewarded in today's day and age, but I learned about integrity. I know not only Minnesota exemplifies that. I'm just saying, living in Hollywood all these years, it's a little more rare. I learned how to be, I've always had moxie. I've always had chutzpah. I've always been plucky. But I also have learned how to do the work. I've learned the value of work. I've learned the value of not working too, but I've learned the value of work. And so when times get tough, it does not faze me. I might get a little freaked out for a second, but then it's like, okay, bear down. Let's just do it. Here we go. So I was thinking also about whether or not I would talk about my years as a massage therapist. I did massage therapy from the age of 19. So I did it up until last year. That's 25 years, long time. And I didn't always love it. Toward the end, I only had, like the last 5 years, I only had like a couple of clients because I just couldn't let go of my last few clients. I just wasn't ready. And I was grateful because I got to keep my favorite people. You know, I let go of the people that, sorry, if you're listening to this and you're like, what? You told me 5 years ago you retired. Well, you were not my favorite client. Sorry. They're probably not listening to this show. But, and if they are, well, I guess like Lizzo says, truth hurts. But long time. And in that capacity, I learned a lot. And I was remembering this experience I had. It was before hashtag Me Too. It was with a client who was, it was in around 2008, 2009, 2010. So I had released it, was just releasing an album with my label. Then that was falling apart. And my acting career was okay. And I was doing like tarot card readings and astrology readings privately or at parties. I did a lot of parties. I did a lot of bar and bat mitzvahs. And then I was also doing massage therapy. And times were a little tough because it was financially, it was the end of the, you know, the a very difficult financially time financially for our country. So I was pretty hungry. Sometimes I was making the choice between, you know, food or acting classes financially. So I had this client, and he was the showrunner, which means executive producer of a very famous television show. I won't say which one. But he always wanted his massages at a hotel room. So he would get a hotel room. And so he would pay me for the massage and pay for the hotel room because he didn't want his wife to know he was getting massages from a young, pretty young woman. And I was always like, but, you know, like you could just tell her this isn't like a sexual massage. This is a therapeutic massage. And he was always like, oh, is it? Right? He was always trying to push my boundaries. I've told this story before, I think, on this show. And I was very good because I grew up in the entertainment industry. I didn't grow up in the entertainment industry, but I had been in the entertainment industry since I was 17. I had been a musician. I had been in bands. I had done theater. And even at, whether you're in Minneapolis or California, it happened all over. And I learned how to keep aggressive men at arm's length as much as possible, right? I learned how to keep people not too close. And if somebody was very aggressive, I had some pretty bad experiences when I first moved to LA. I learned really fast that if somebody was that aggressive, just don't go there. Just don't. Sometimes you don't know. Sometimes someone sneaks things up on you. That happened to me too. Well, this guy started asking me to be his only client. He wanted to be my sugar daddy. He said if I was his only client, I would just see him once a week, give him a happy ending massage, and he would pay my rent, my acting classes, pay for these trips I was taking to India. And at the time, I even spoke with my acting teacher about it, who was also taking me to India to meet this guru. And she was like, the thing is, Aaron, is that it would mess with your self-esteem. There are people who can do this. There are people who can be sugar babies. There are people who can do happy ending massages because they think it's fun, because they think it's an enjoyable thing to do. And they don't have a hang up about it. But you, and I remember she said, you with your Minnesota mind, you have a hang up about it. And it would mess with your self-esteem, so you can't do it. So I told the guy no. Well, he kept pushing. He kept wanting to push and push and push. And then one day he said, hey, I'm producing a film with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, and there's a role you could be right for. You would be playing one of their daughters. She gets killed at the very beginning of the movie, but it's the thing that sets the whole movie rolling, and you would be remembered because, you know, you would be the daughter. So if you give me a happy ending, I will get you the audition for that movie. And I was kind of sick of his BS at that point, but I was also like, yeah. I knew how to handle this guy at this point. I just said, tell you what, get me the audition and then I'll give you the happy ending. Now, between you and me, I don't know if I would have, but I was just like, put your money where your mouth is, buddy, right? And he pulled his, I'll never forget this, he pulled his face out of the face cradle. He turned to look at me, he laughed, and he said, you're going to do great in this town, kid. He put his face back in the face cradle. We continued the massage. And guess who never got me that audition? Because he was never going to get me that audition. So I was thinking of that story in context of, should I bring it back for my one-woman show? When all of a sudden I thought of an idea for a fun movie, which is about a woman who's, a, you know, circa 30 on either side of 30. And she is broke. She needs money. She doesn't have, you know, anyone to help her out financially. She's looking for jobs, but jobs don't pay well, even though she has a good degree in journalism, right? So she's not making money. And her friend is a sugar baby, and her friend makes it look easy. So she decides she's going to try being a sugar baby, A, because she's going to try to turn it into a story as a writer. Like, she wants to be a narrative nonfiction writer. She wants to be a journalist, the kind of journalist who writes, like, books, like Joan Didion, like Susan Orlean, like Catherine Boo. So she's going to try to turn it into a really cool, you know, expose-type story and maybe make a little cash along the way. Only this particular person is super blunt, and she's not capable of doing the things that maybe you need to do to be a sugar baby. Like, she just can't suffer fools. She just can't stand the idea of having to, like, keep herself small in exchange for, you know, fawning over a man that she just doesn't really respect or doesn't really think is all that smart. So it's sort of the book, that was the idea for the movie. So then when these publishers said, you know, any other ideas, I told them this idea and they loved it. And then suddenly I wrote it. I was like, okay, I'll put no pressure on myself. If I get it done in time, great. If I don't, great. but I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And so I was getting up at like 4 and 5 in the morning to write this little novella. And I think I wrote 5 drafts and I sent it to them. And then we did 3 edits and this is the book that you get. And normally, let me tell you, I rewrite a book like 50 times. I am a rewriter. I like to rewrite. I rewrite, I rewrite. But the truth, I think, is the difference between the draft that I have in my hands and if I had another year with it, probably I could come up with some more fun stuff and flesh some things out or not. Maybe I would. I'm mainly when I reread it, I'm like, it's like we're down to the minutia of, oh, would I rearrange these 2 words? Oh, would I use a slightly different synonym? I mean, it's like the minutia of things. I'm very proud of the book. And people, so far, I'm very grateful. People have been enjoying it. It's been getting some good reviews. And you can get it if you're on Kindle. Right now it's on, it's actually free if you're a Kindle user. Or it's $6.99 as a paperback on Amazon. And in fact, even my German pen pal, I already talked about her, but she ordered it in Germany. You can order it almost anywhere in the world. And if you are living somewhere where you cannot get a copy of it, message me. Find me, email me, and I will find a way to get you a copy. Okay, we'll find a way if you want to read it. So the book is about Ollie is the main character. And Ollie is a blunt, cash-strapped 31-year-old aspiring writer. She finds herself pink-slipped from her gig as a social media manager slash de facto personal lackey to a reality TV diva slash influencer. And it's all because she just got tired of sugarcoating the truth. So with her bills piling high and her dreams on hold, she hatches a scheme to dive into the sugar baby lifestyle, intending to chronicle her misadventures for publication and maybe make a quick buck along the way. But with a serious allergy to nonsense and a talent for putting her foot in her mouth, she's in for a roller coaster of tangled lies and curveball revelations that becomes a crash course in the true worth and cost of love and life. The main character is Ollie Sills. She is fiercely smart, she's enterprising, and she dreams, like I said, of becoming a renowned reportage-style writer of narrative nonfiction. So her relentless honesty and her inability to suffer fools, especially those who are more successful than her, often land her in hot water. She is a flawed person. I mean, we all are, but she's a flawed character. Her most recent job loss, for being too candid, really only adds to her struggles in a society that values appearance, presentation, and flattery over substance. So I wrote this book to be fun. You can read it at one level, and it's just a fun, cute, exciting, easy breezy summer beach read. But I also wrote it, honestly, at another level to be a bit of a critique of social media and of marketing and of how a woman is supposed to be according to social media, what a woman is supposed to look like according to social media, what a person is supposed to look like or be or how they're supposed to behave and what they're supposed to want in life according to social media compared to what it really feels like to just be yourself. Because Ollie is so deeply, truly herself. And in the end, she finds out that all of the time she was trying to be anything other than herself, which she doesn't want to, but she thinks she needs to make money or to fit in or to have success, doesn't work for her. It just doesn't. But when she is so deeply, truly herself, she starts to find her way. And still life happens, still painful things happen, but they happen to someone who gets to be herself and be loved for herself rather than a fake version of herself. So I really, really wanted to write something about someone who is herself. And her best friend is herself. And her best friend's son, because her best friend's a single mom, he's himself. And the people who come into their lives who help teach them things from whom they learn, they're just themselves. The people who don't learn in this book are the people who are trying to be something that pleases everybody according to marketing or media versus being themselves. So I kind of really wanted to critique culture a little bit, but in a fun way, right? In a way that's like a fun thing to read and enjoyable. So you could read it at multiple levels if you wanted, right?
And so this brings me to writing for healing. Now, I don't think I'll have time to walk you through some of the processes that I wanted to share with you. So maybe that's what we'll do next week. But I found some healing writing this book, even though I wasn't intending to write it. Like, it's not about me. I am not Ollie. There's shades of her in me, but she is way more honest than I am, way more blunt, I should say. What was healing for me was remembering some of the experiences I have had in my life and allowing myself to, I wrote so here's how I wrote the book. I came up with the idea for the structure of how this could work. So Ollie, there's a prologue. So the book has chapters, but not traditional chapters. The book has a prologue, and then she decides she's going to have rules for herself to protect herself as a sugar baby. So each quote-unquote chapter starts with a rule and ends with a lesson. So for example, rule one, in my desire to dive deep into the life of a sugar baby and understand it as an intersectional study of economic inequality, gender politics, societal norms, marketing, self-help ideology, and consumer culture, I decided to employ a fundamental rule designed to protect my privacy. Commit to an identity online and in person that protects my deepest self until trust is well established. And I don't want to give too much away, but she has a couple misadventures trying to be someone she's not. And lesson one, men are going to lie about things on these websites too, sometimes on purpose. They may lie about their age, height, weight, balding status, and more, and sometimes without ever realizing it. For example, they may think they want a sugar baby, but they really just want a call girl. They may think they want a sugar baby, but they want a real regular girlfriend. They may not even know what they want. Therefore, it's best to be your damn self. Right? So that's as an example. So I came up with the idea that she would have a series of rules, and then I chose 7 because 7 is my lucky number. So there are 7 rules, and therefore there are 7 lessons. And once I found that structure, I began brainstorming all of the different aspects of what a sugar baby life might include, all of the different things that you might have to do as a sugar baby, things you might learn about yourself as a sugar baby, troubles you might encounter, dangers you might encounter, how you would get out of it. How do you communicate with other people in your life about what you're doing or not? How do you hide it? Do you include your friends or not? How do you negotiate financially with a sugar daddy? What happens when you need to end things with a sugar daddy? What happens if you start really falling in love with a sugar daddy, right? So I thought about all these different things, and then I started brainstorming things that could happen to her in context of that, specifically to Ollie as a character. But I also started remembering a lot of my own personal experiences, not as a sugar baby, but as a massage therapist. Now, I didn't even do happy endings, which whatever, if that's what you want to do. Like I always say, you do you, kids. But I never did that. But like just the things that people thought I should do or wanted me to do or expected I would do for them. And then the things people told me. Also, I had a couple friends who were sugar babies, and I remembered some of the stories they told me about some of the ridiculous dates they went on. And I remembered some of them did quite well. One of them was just such a smart businesswoman. She took the money she made as a sugar baby and she invested it in property, stocks, bonds, a bathing suit company. She also had been a Playboy playmate. Like she had a sugar daddy first. She got the sugar daddy to buy her some plastic surgery. Then she became a playmate. And then she, from there, started her swimwear line. But she also continued having extremely wealthy sugar daddies. And she took that money and invested it so that by the time she was in her mid-30s, she never had to have a sugar daddy again unless she wanted to. She just knew how to invest money and became very wealthy. So I'm not saying that's for everybody. I know there's probably a lot of people in the world who are morally against that or who are clutching their pearls at the thought of that. You might have guessed by now, I'm really very, like, people should be themselves about life. And I wouldn't want to judge anybody for what is their own story and what is their own emotional integrity, right? One of the things I wanted to do was make sure that Ollie wasn't traumatized by her experiences as a sugar baby. Now, that doesn't mean they're all easy. A lot of them are hard, and sometimes they hurt her. But this is not trauma porn. This is not a book about trauma porn. And, you know, like when people talk about Marilyn Monroe, and they just love to talk about all the trauma she went through, and they just go on and on and on about it. And then they also try to make sure that you, too, feel her trauma porn, and that it's a cautionary tale that anybody who's famous must have slept their way to the top, which is all a bunch of hooey and also totally unfair to... If you weren't there, you don't know what happened. And unfair to, it was a different time and place. And unfair to, we don't know, right? Like unfair to the actual joy of Marilyn Monroe's life and the actual talent she had and the actual gifts that she brought and gave to all of us. See, I have a real issue with trauma porn. And I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about trauma or that we shouldn't deal with trauma. Of course we should. And I'm not saying it was okay what the men in her life did to her. Of course I hate it. But I'm saying... somebody is so much more than just drama porn. And I definitely wanted to write something that was fun and sexy, more along the lines of Pretty Woman meets Fleabag, right? More like that. So I would say if you like Pretty Woman, if you like Fleabag, if you like Bridget Jones, if you like Sex and the City, you're going to like Bad Sugar Baby. But what was healing for me writing this book was remembering some of these just ridiculous things people had no problem saying to me or thinking to me. And I, when it was something that was personal that I thought about including in the book, I decided to take note and do my spiritual writing process. And so I was therefore mining my own life history for areas that were still triggering to me. Things where I still had some pain or anger, frustration, leftover stuck energy, resentment, bitterness. Sometimes righteous anger, and sometimes just habitual anger. And I decided to do my writing process about that. So writing the book itself, because I also wrote the book to be both poignant and funny, I got a lot of healing out of it because comedy can really heal, right? They say tragedy plus time is comedy. Sorry, I need a water. Let's all take a moment to take our throat spray. Thank you. Allergies. But to me, I got to see other sides of my stories rather than repeat the same story over and over. Oh, that terrible showrunner client of mine who never helped me in my career. And I dodged a bullet of becoming a sugar baby to somebody who wasn't really going to help me, but was really going to control me, which I think happens is a big, serious danger when people have sugar daddies or even just like I certainly had a boyfriend when I was in my 20s who was older than me and who promised to try to help me with my life, but he really wasn't going to help me. He just wanted to control me, and he ended up becoming very controlling, and he still tries to control me periodically showing up in my life, right? It's still about control. It is not about love. It's about control. But I was able to also look at it from other perspectives. Now, I don't like the bad things that happened to me, but I have healed from them. And I know what it's like to be on the other side. And I can help other people. I can hold space for other people who've gone through that. And I can make fun of the ridiculousness of the gentle levels. Like, I've healed enough that I can have a sense of humor about the varying degrees of severity of the way people treat each other. Because sometimes the way a person is treating another person is so severe, it isn't funny and it should be handled with care. Sometimes the way a person is treating others is something to be made fun of. And I know we're living in a world in a day and age where comedy is a little bit on edge because, you know, a lot of the old ways of doing comedy have become toxic and we need to come up with some new ways of doing comedy. But at the same time, at this moment in time, culturally, I think it's totally appropriate to make fun of a ridiculous person who's trying to use money to control another person and or trying to use sex to control another person, right? So the healing process, we don't have time for me to talk about the whole healing process of writing. So next week I'm going to share, we've done it before on the show, but it's a writing process that I've used. It's something I've developed over the years based somewhat on 12-step work, somewhat on work that Julia Cameron teaches in The Artist's Way, somewhat that I've just developed myself, somewhat doing surrender, the concept of spiritual surrender. So it's sort of like an amalgamation of a lot of different techniques I've learned over the years. It's not a fast process, but it's not a slow process either. And I would like next week to talk about the writing process that I use specifically for healing the past, healing things that hurt me, healing old beliefs, healing things that I, you know, practices I had in place for years without realizing it, for example. And then we'll also talk about how, if you choose, you can take some of that writing and you can turn it into your own story. You can turn it into a work of fiction or a memoir, an essay, a poem, a song, a play, a screenplay, a movie, you know, a musical, whatever you want to do. But I often find people are better served to write about their lives, if they're using their lives as inspiration, after they've done some work on their lives. Because you don't want to run into a situation where you trigger yourself back into a painful experience without someone to help hold your hand through that, without someone to help you heal through that, without someone to hold space, right? Whether that person is a healer, someone here at One to Listen, a therapist, a doctor, or just a very wise and caring friend whose agenda for you is that you are healed and whole. It doesn't matter who, as long as it's somebody who has your best interest at heart, right? But we'll talk about that next week as well. Until then, I would love to see you over at onetolisten.com. You can find me at onetolisten.com/Erin. I'll be there a lot of today and then most of tomorrow. And if you want to know more about Bad Sugar Baby, I'll put a link up in the chat room, but it is also available on Amazon. Just, you can Google Bad Sugar Baby Erin Carrera and take a look for yourself. And like I said, if you live somewhere where it's not available for some reason, please reach out to me. I will make sure that you get a copy, because if somebody really wants to read it, of course, I want you to read it. So let me know. All right. Until next week, I will be available on onetolisten.com/Erin. I love you. Bye-bye.